I was not here last Sunday because I was in Florida attending the funeral of my Uncle Harold Martin. He's a special man to me, and I wanted to take a few minutes this morning to let you know why. And I was also honored and privileged that the family asked me to do the eulogy, which I did. You may have noticed, if you've been here for a good while, how I will crane my neck around and try to pop it and get it screwed back on. There are reasons for that. As I get older, the problem gets worse. I wanted to relate to you this morning why I have that problem and how my Uncle Harold reads into this. I will tell you before I start that my Uncle Harold was a demonstration of thought, decision, and application of the doctrine that he knew. As I met people with whom he worked at the funeral service, members of the family who have had far more personal relationships with him than I because they live in the general area in which he did, I found out that he was a man of great integrity and honor, and that was recognized by many who had dealings with him. When I was 10 years old, I was required to go down to Opp, Alabama. That's OPP. My dad called it zero PP. The city was, I know, he always came up with something. But the city considered itself the city of opportunity. It was a little small town, and that's where my grandparents lived. And my uncle, who was one of my mother's younger brothers, was working on the farm. And I want to give you a little relationship of how I learned to drive. When I was down there in the summer of 1951, there was this Willys Jeep. And if you don't know what a Willys Jeep looks like from World War II, there it is. This is a perfect replica without the doors. It had no doors on it. It did have a spare rack that is very important to the story. I asked Uncle Harold, why did you take the doors off the Jeep? And he said it didn't have any doors when I bought it. He was working on a farm. He didn't have any money. He was out of high school, and he had gone to World War II. He was in the Pacific Theater, a bombardier on a privateer, which is the Navy's version of the Army Air Corps B-24. He sat right in the front of the plane and dropped depth charges on submarines. So he took a little time to do that. And then when he got out of the Navy, he decided to go to Alabama Polytechnic Institute. So he was buying this Jeep in order to get from Opp, Alabama to Auburn, Alabama, which is where Alabama Polytechnic Institute was located then. He said, it was salvaged from World War II and I got it cheap. I just need it for riding around the farm and for going to school in September and get in, me and my cousin Tommy, get in and I'll teach you boys how to drive. This is how I was introduced at age 10 to a 1951 version of driver's ed. My grandparents ran this farm outside of Opp, where my mother's brother, Uncle Harold, lived when he was not attending what came to be later Auburn, a little cow town over in East Alabama. But in the summers, he conducted this boot camp for me and my cousin Tommy. We were given a two-week refresher course each year in the strict discipline required of farmhands and were abject failures. Tommy was from Pensacola and thus knew more about beaches than farm fields. I was from Troy, a city boy, and I didn't know anything about dirt roads, just paved ones. But the summer session of 51 had this exciting distinction and therefore distraction from our labors. I can attest that an open cow pasture is an excellent place to learn how to drive. There's no traffic, there's no laws, and there are no lanes. Just get it started, let out the clutch, suffer minor whiplash, and then steer. The trick was learning how to manipulate the manual transmission, which was stick shift in the floor, four speed. I just turned 10 and I didn't have much of a reach, but I was willing to learn. The trick was learning how, to shift the gears with the clutch. Within a day, I'd mastered the clutch and the shifting. By the end of our two-week tour of duty, Tommy and I were driving up and down the dirt road that passed in front of the farmhouse. And we were excited about learning to drive, and therefore we had mixed emotions about leaving for home. The upside was getting away from Uncle Harold's farm chores. Therefore, we were ready to get back to city life. About a month later, on September the 10th of 1951, Uncle Harold dropped by our house in Troy on his way up to API to enroll. Now, why I keep calling it API, it was not Auburn until somewhere around the early 60s. It was Sunday afternoon, and my close friend Andy Harrell and his parents were over visiting. And when Uncle Harold arrived, I was excited to see that Army Green Willys. The Willys Jeep came into popularity among general public at the end of World War II. Willys Overland Motors reports on its website that it was awarded a contract to build Jeeps for the U.S. Army in late 1940. Ford was awarded a contract a week later. Of the roughly 500,000 Jeeps produced for World War II, Willys Overland made about 360,000 between 1941 and 1945. The Jeeps proved to be rugged and dependable in the war. By the time the soldiers came home, Jeeps were well known and loved for their durability and unstoppability. That was the way Willys Overland described their vehicle. Durable and unstoppable. Oh, really? This may have been true for our men-at-arms in the great World War II, but the Army vets had not yet met the driving experience of a 10-year-old. Andy heard I'd learned to drive the thing and pestered Uncle Harold and me to take him for a ride. My parents, distracted with all of the company in the house, buckled under the pressure and said I could do it if I only went down to the pool, the city pool, and back. Our house was on the corner of North Three Notch. You don't know about that. Andy Jackson, on his way to New Orleans, blazed a trail by three notches on trees, which took him through Troy, Alabama, before it became that. And the main drag there is named Three Notch because of Jackson's procedure. And it was on the corner of Pearson, a little dirt road that ran by the house. Perfect arrangement for my training. It ran two blocks west to Murfree Park and dead-ended at China Street. I hopped in the driver's seat, Andy in the middle, my Uncle Harold rode shotgun, I fired her up, and we headed out. If you put the wheels in the ruts of a dirt road, any vehicle is easy to steer. In those days, the street that circled down by the pool and pavilion was asphalt. It was also a one-way road, so that when you arrived at the entrance to the park, there were two sets of ruts. One set going straight to China Street, but the other set veered off to the right and then merged with the asphalt. The Jeep hugged these ruts and put us up on the hardtop very nicely, but I'd gotten lazy and did not pull the Jeep out of the rut-directed turn, and as a result, it continued to veer to the right and head directly toward a pine tree 100 feet tall with a diameter of about 3 feet. It was a rude introduction. Mr. Willys, meet Mr. Pine. Mr. Pine was not impressed with Willys Overland's claim that its product was unstoppable. I can boldly assure you that it was, and it was instant. Several of these tall pines lined the drive around the park, and this first one was growing on a slight incline a few feet off the road. The unstoppable object lost to the immovable tree, and the Jeep tipped over. With no door to keep us inside, I fell backwards out of the driver's seat onto the asphalt, followed quickly by Mr. Jeep. My head got it from both sides. First, my scalp was ripped away from my head by the rough asphalt, and the roof of the Jeep hit my forehead, fracturing my skull. Had it not been for the fact that Willys Overland designed their Jeeps with a spare tire mount on the driver's side, the edge of the Jeep's roof would have crushed my skull instead. The spare mount kept it off the ground just enough for me to survive. I don't know the lady's name who was the supervisor of Murfree Park at the time, but she heard the crash and called the police and an ambulance. Their arrivals were tardy. Uncle Harold leaned over into the Jeep from the passenger side, now pointed to the heavens, to pull me through the cab, but my arm was trapped beneath the Jeep's side in the asphalt. I maintained enough consciousness to tell him of the problem. He ran a 180 around to the other side, put his farm work strengthened arms underneath the edge of the roof, and lifted the Jeep off of me so that I could free my arm. I then remember holding my arms up and him clutching them tightly and pulling me out. My grandfather, Alex Griffin, had a new 1950 Ford and an intuition that he should follow us on our venture, both of which placed him at the scene when the accident occurred. As my uncle got to the car, I remember my grandfather asking, "Do you want to take him back home?" To which Harold replied, "No, we need to get him to a hospital." Pearson Street to China, one block. China to Murfree, one block. Murfree to Pine, one block. Pine to Beard's Hospital, two blocks. We made the trip in less than 3 minutes. I remember as we entered the hospital, nurses were awaiting our arrival in response to a third phone call made by the lady at the park. They, in turn, had contacted Dr. James O'Colley, Jr., who was on call that weekend, and he arrived from his home, which was only about 5 or 6 blocks away, at the same time we did. During all of this, I remained conscious. By the time I entered the operating room, the pain was beginning to set in, and I remember writhing on the gurney until a nurse put a mask over my face and told me to breathe in while counting to 100. I made it to 3. I have no recall of how long I was under sedation. I never thought to ask, but here's what went on in the OR. Dr. Colley ordered x-rays of my head, which I was shown later. If you've ever seen a pane of glass shot through with a bullet, then you've seen that x-ray. A central hole with fractures reaching outward from its circumference in jagged lines. My scalp was peeled back, exposing an inverted U-shaped portion of my skull. I had stuck my head under a Jeep, and the results were not pretty. I must now report to secondhand descriptions of post-ether administered events. Dr. Colley, or Tip, as he was affectionately known by all, every man in my hometown had a nickname. You know Speed. Well, his name was Tip. He'd never dealt with a mess such as this. Usually, cases involving this kind of trauma were soon handed off to the local undertaker, Robert A. McGee. Not this time. God's plan still included me, and so events transpired to keep my soul installed in my body long enough for Tip to figure out what to do. And what he did was call the head of neurology at University Medical Center in Birmingham. There's a principal there, when in doubt, call the University of Alabama, Rammer Jammer. Tip, with a telephone by the operating table, was talked through the intricate process of piecing my head back together. The shattered nature of my skull led the neurologist to advise against inserting a steel plate in my forehead. Just stop the bleeding, suture it up, hope for the best. All told, I had 99 stitches installed in my forehead and scalp. Tip announced to my parents that he had done all he could, but that the chances of my survival were slim. He advised them to consider making funeral arrangements. Well, such action was not required. Through the grace of God, I survived, but not without pestering nurses for 6 weeks in the hospital, and my parents for much of the rest of the year at home. While residing at Beard's, I received 3 shots a day, one each of terramycin, streptomycin, and penicillin. The 10-year-old's south side isn't big enough to accommodate that much incoming artillery. They ultimately opted for my lower back. I soon got used to the attacks so that on a nurse's arrival, I would turn on my side, pull down my pajamas, and get the injection without missing a word or a panel of the comic book I was reading. All through the convalescence, I was treated with a superabundance of grace from friends, relatives, and members of the community. But for several days in the mid-September of 1951, things didn't look that good for my survival in what I considered a real-life version of Bedford Falls. I had to go to summer school under Ms. Zuby Smart, who lived only 2 doors down the street. I probably should have repeated the 5th grade. In fact, I probably should have repeated all of my grades. The next year I was promoted to Miss Rosa Powell's sixth grade, and from that point on I didn't do well in school. I was just happy to be alive. One of the ramifications, therefore, of the injury was that tendons and ligaments in my neck were stretched in a contorted fashion and have never gone back to their original place. So my head was hit in this fashion, and so my head wants to go this way. And so I constantly have to rearrange things. I go to a chiropractor once a month, and he screws my head back on straight. And it works for maybe 3 days. Why am I telling you all of this? My survival and recovery was made possible by the grace of God. But these blessings would not have been possible without the farm work strength and arms of my Uncle Harold, who lifted that Jeep off of my arm, and I've always looked on him as a man who saved my life. And I was very, very pleased and honored that the family would ask me to do his eulogy. So I hope you don't mind me relating this to you. Many of you may have wanted to know what's with your forehead. Well, I stuck my head under a Jeep, and it did not turn out real well. But Uncle Harold was very special, so that's why I took the time off. I was going to go anyhow. I had to go to that funeral. But I was also very pleased the family asked me to do the eulogy. Please pray for my Aunt Daisy. She has a loss of short-term memory. Her daughter lives in Tallahassee, and her son does live in the Gainesville, Florida area. But he of course, has a job, so be in prayer for her. She and my Uncle Harold are in the prayer bulletin, but, of course, we'll delete him at the next bulletin. Now, in our study, and we will move forward with that and have just a few minutes to orient to where we are in our study and then resume with gusto in the second session. We have been noting the battle in the Valley of Elah, and over the course of some midweek sessions, I've shown you this particular map. When I'm reading about a battle in a book of some kind, and they start talking about where the encampments are and some of the topographical features, but they don't have a map. And I find it's pretty much impossible to understand a battle unless you have some kind of map to go with it. And so I plundered around in all of my books and found this one, and it's the best that I could find for the Valley of Elah and the battle that went on there. It was a one-on-one, but still a battle. We noted in our studies recently about how all of this came about, David arriving on the scene to take food to his brothers, the elder three, that were in the Israeli army and deployed to this particular engagement. And his father, Jesse, wanted him to take some food down to them. Now, for David, the trip from Bethlehem, which you can see right here, it says from Bethlehem, the Valley of Elah is pretty much on the same latitude with Bethlehem, so it was due west for him. And it's pretty much downhill. So it's estimated that David, a young man who was very well put together physically, could have made that trip by running in about 3 hours. So if you were to walk it, it would take maybe more, around 6 or 7. But he was able to get over there, obviously, the same day he left, and to take this food to his elder brothers. Now, we noted in previous studies when he got there, none other than Goliath of Gath is down in the valley, bellowing, offering very critical remarks about the Israeli army, challenging them, scoffing at them, taunting them. And when David hears this, he becomes very upset that everybody's sitting around and not doing anything about it. And so he wants to know why this uncircumcised Philistine is getting away with this. And his brother dresses him down for it. This is his oldest brother, Eliab. So there's no telling how many years difference between the oldest brother and the youngest, who is David. And I'm sure David had received a lot of static from his elder brother over the years. So he just says, hey, I'm just asking a question. What's wrong with that? And so the news gets back to Saul that David has asked this question. And Saul asks him to come into his headquarters. Now, the headquarters for the Jewish army is at Beit Natif, and that is noted in the blue triangle. It is to the north side of the Wadi Esunt, and this is a arroyo-type passageway for rainwater from the central highlands or from melting snow. And so at this time, it is most likely bare of water, but the runway is filled with rocks, and that will be the source of David's artillery. On the south side and to the west, south side of the wadi, but to the west is Ephrath Damim, and that is where it is estimated that the Philistine army had its headquarters. There are two cities. You have Azekah, which you see just to the north of Ephrath Damim, and Soko, which is across the wadi from Beit Netif. So these are the locations that will come into view as we note the battle and what happens afterward. Also, please be advised that David does meet with Saul, and he tells Saul that he will go down into the valley and he will take on this giant, because the giant is challenging the God of Israel and the God of the Israeli army, and there's no way he can get away with that, so I will take the deed and the duty. So the Philistine headquarters, you will note, is situated between Azekah and Soko at a site identified as Ephrath Damim, while the Jews were situated northeast of Soko at Beit Netif in the valley of Elah. The brook Wadi Esunt separated the two camps. Now, a wadi is a valley or ravine bounded by relatively steep banks, which in the rainy season becomes a water course. We have that kind of thing in the West called arroyos. Its bed, therefore, provided a broad selection of smooth stones. This is where David selected five that we'll note later on in 1 Samuel 17, verse 40. David put the stones in his shepherd's bag. His sling was in his hand, and he advanced on the Philistine. And Goliath was not impressed with what he saw. Now, we've noted in the past, and we'll note again, that Goliath was 9 feet 6 inches tall, according to the scriptures. That is a very tall guy. David is about 16 or so, and he may be 6 feet. Who knows? But he wound up being a pretty big guy, and therefore by 16 he may have been 6 feet at the most. So he's taking on a guy that not only outweighs him by hundreds of pounds, but he's got him by about 3 feet or more. So this is what David's up against. So we note in 1 Samuel 17:43, the Philistine said to David, "Hey, buddy, am I a dog? You come out here with a stick?" See, he's insulted that David's coming out there with a slingshot. Slingshot's got a stick and then some kind of elastic thing that you can launch a rock. And so he says, "Am I a dog that you're going to take me on with a stick?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. So, well, what was the god of the Philistines? Well, they had many, but the chief god was Dagon. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of Dagon. I didn't look one up. But Dagon had the head and arms and torso of a man, and then the lower portion was that of a fish. So Dagon was like a fish god. It's amazing what people worship, isn't it? And they had a temple for Dagon in which there was this replica, this statue, this bric-a-brac of Dagon, and he stands there holding court in his temple, and he's got an upper torso, head and arms of a man, and then lower of a... I don't know how you balance that, do you... I know, must have been something sticking to him somewhere to keep him falling over. I mean, how can a tail of a fish hold you up? Nevertheless, you see the problem that they had worshiping a fish god. So he is the fellow that the Philistine, Goliath, is referencing. He cursed David and the Israeli army and the Israeli people by his gods, emphasizing Dagon. Verse 44. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." The birds of the sky would be birds of prey. I was standing out front the last Sunday we met, and little Max Hunt was out there. And we were carrying on a conversation. And all of a sudden, I hear Max, and he's pointing behind me. And he says, "Bird of prey," pointing up in the sky. So we all turned around, and sure enough, there's this hawk way off in the distance. So he has pretty good eyesight. So I laughed about that, and I've thought about bird of prey a lot since then. And that's exactly what what Goliath was saying, that he's, I'm going to kill you and birds of prey are going to come and gnaw your flesh. And the beast of the field, he says. So David was in no way cowed by Goliath's bloviation. A 16-year-old up against this, and he doesn't flinch. How about that for confidence and courage? How about that for a mental attitude that is locked in? See, what he believes is that there is no way that this uncircumcised Philistine, which means he's a heathen, this uncircumcised Philistine can in any way challenge and be successful against the God of Israel and the God of the Israeli army. Whatever goes on here today, I'll win because God will not permit this. He fired right back at the big oaf with what amounted to a prophecy. Now this is where we get in to what David thinks. Verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted." See, that was the deal with David. You don't taunt the people of Israel. You do not taunt the army of Israel. Who do you think you are? Now, the word taunt here in the Hebrew is harap, H-A-R-A-P-H, harap. It means malicious, belittling. It suggests jeeringly provoking insult and challenge. It comes from the Latin ridiculum, which means to jest. So he's making fun of. He was besmirching the Israeli army and the Israeli people. The people of God and the army of God. And David said, that will not stand. Now what we learn from this is that David is taking on a giant. And he's taking on the giant with great confidence. And what is his mental attitude about taking on giants? The battle is the Lord's. That is who wins the battle. David could not go out on that battlefield alone and expect to have victory over that guy. He was going to be eaten up and spit out to the birds of prey and the beast of the field. Do not think you can fight your battles alone. What did he go on to say? This day, the Lord will deliver you up to my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. Now, he's talking to this 9'6 guy. I'm going to take off your head. And he's, of course, Goliath thinking, you can't even reach my head. You can't reach my head. What are you thinking? I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of prey and wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. I would think that Goliath is thinking, you're talking to me about taunting. You're taunting me. Don't you think he's getting ticked about this time? And then he continues, this is the coup de grace. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's. He will give you into our hands. And that's what he said to Goliath. He didn't flinch. He didn't slack off. He didn't leave anything out. He told the man he was about to die. Now, from this passage, we see David apply a cluster of divine viewpoint principles. There are quite a number of them here that I need to go through. There must be numbers beyond which I can count. So why fracture that up? I've taken your time this morning going down memory lane for why I do things like that. And that now you know. Now you understand why it was important for me to go away for a while and do that funeral. So it's only a couple of minutes left before halftime. We will come back at about 10 till the hour, and we'll take up a cluster of divine viewpoint principles that emerge from this passage. So now it's time for tea and crumpets.